Hi, this is Karin Zissis with ASCOA Online. Brazil started the new year with a new president, Jair Bolsonaro, also known as the Trump of the tropics. But despite temptations to find similarities between the two leaders, Bolsonaro faces his own set of problems, such as his country's struggling economy. My colleague Elizabeth Gonzalez sat down with ASCOA Brazil experts, Brian Winter and Roberto Simon of America's Quarterly. As Bolsonaro rounds out his first 3 months in office, they cover how his presidency has gone so far and what might come next.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
I'd like to welcome back onto the podcast Brian Winter and Roberto Simon. Thank you for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
It's good to be here.
So last year, we had a conversation a month out from Brazil's elections in which we discussed the various factors at play in the rising popularity of then-candidate, now-president, Jair Bolsonaro. We identified the economy, violence, corruption as some of the issues driving voters to the polls. And now with the president's honeymoon coming to an end, I'd like to discuss Bolsonaro's progress so far on exactly those issues. But first, let's start with big picture. How would you rate the president's first 3 months in office, say, on an A to F grading scale? Too hard?
Next question, please.
I would say this. His honeymoon is over. I mean, usually there's this tradition that the honeymoon lasts 100 days. And in the case of Bolsonaro, in part through some self-inflicted and really unnecessary conflicts that he had, not with his enemies, but with his friends, there's a general recognition right now in Brazil that the honeymoon period is over and he's now into sort of the meat of his presidency.
Yeah, and I think 15 percentage points drop in approval ratings in 3 months. It's, you know, it's the evidence, all the evidence that you need to say this is over now. Real life, the real marriage begins, right?
Time to get down to business.
Well, and in a country that still has the same problems that we talked about when we last sat down late last year prior to the election, there have been so many comparisons over the years between Jair Bolsonaro and Donald Trump. But one major difference between the two of them was, of course, President Trump inherited an economy that was growing and in good shape, as much as he might have said to the contrary. And of course, it's gotten better since he came into office. In the case of Bolsonaro, this is an economy that is still, you know, hurting from the worst, the deepest and longest recession in its history. The fire has sort of gone out. It's not as bad as it was in 2015 and 2016, but it's not really recovering. Inflation's low, but unemployment is still above 12%. There have been some signs of February was a good month for job creation. More people seem to be coming into the labor market. The signs aren't all bad, but he's got a lot of work to do. And the big difference with Trump is he's not going to be able to count on that goodwill from people if he doesn't show signs of progress quickly.
And the business community is watching, right? Especially investors who are looking at the progress of pension reform. Part of the reason that people were enthused about Bolsonaro was because he had this Chicago-trained investment banker, Paulo Guedes, at the head of the economic team. Would you say there is still that same enthusiasm for Bolsonaro's ability to boost the economy, or has that waned?
Yeah, so taking a step back, and I think that's a useful way to connect what we're saying here to what was discussed a month before the election. I think, you know, at that time, Brazilian watchers were divided in, I would say, two main groups, right? Those who thought that Bolsonaro was a passing phenomenon. And the other group was saying, look, I think this time is different. I think Brian and I were both on, you know, the latter camp saying Bolsonaro could, you know, certainly be the next president of Brazil. The question now is, when it comes to negotiating to Congress to pass pension reform and other key legislations, can you overhaul the system and completely fight the structures and that are there and that have, you know, determined Brazilian politics for decades? Does it still work? Can you still be an outsider when you're president, right? And what we're seeing is that the answer is a big no, right? Bolsonaro, at least for now, hasn't really found a way to negotiate directly with Congress to pass legislation. And I'm not even saying, you know, the type of pork barrel negotiation that has kind of contaminated Brazilian politics. It's not about that, because now we have the upper echelon of the government already determined. You don't have parties who own ministries like it, we had with under, you know, the PT or even before with the PSDB administration. But the point is, at some level, you have to sit down with members of Congress. You need people in your team to push forward legislation and to, you know, accommodate certain interests. And that's politics that happens, you know, in Brazil, in the US, in Chile, or in France, right? And we haven't seen that yet. That so that's kind of the major concern. And that's what I think pretty late in the game, people from Faria Lima and, you know, the financial community in Brazil are realizing, that it's very hard to deliver the Paulo Guedes big promises if you don't have a clear strategy on how to get things done in Congress.
I would just say that you know, I believe I have been surprised by how much trouble Bolsonaro has had pushing things through Congress for this very reason. In fair, I expected them to be more organized, more disciplined, and I think that's been the big surprise for most of the business community so far. I would say though that you know, the jury's still out. There's still time for them to get a lot of these things done, particularly pension reform. If you look at the, you know, the professional kind of political risk analysis firms, the ones who are in places like Brasilia counting votes and talking to legislators every day, which is, you know, for better or for worse, not something that we're able to do from here in New York, most of them still seem to believe that some kind of pension reform will get passed. But it's very uncertain, and, you know, it's not an exaggeration to say that Brazil's economy hangs in the balance.
And the president has, in terms of Congress, he's been kind of shooting himself in the foot, picking some unnecessary fights, perhaps, with the head of the Chamber of Deputies, Rodrigo Maia. I think they sort of made up, or Guedes kind of like smoothed it over. But do you think that they will start to begin working together in the future, or is it contaminated, as you say?
To a certain extent, you know, Bolsonaro is lucky that Rodrigo Maia is very pro pension reform, right? He has a person who's the as you know, the Speaker of the House, who's determined to pass pension reform, and who's you know, who knows a lot about how things work inside Congress. I think Maia's effort at the beginning was just to make sure that Bolsonaro and some of his ministers, like Moro and others, understand how powerful he actually is. And Brazil has a strange system where, you know, you have an extremely powerful Congress and weak parties. This is kind of the story that led to Dilma Rousseff's impeachment and, you know, a lot of instability in other moments in Brazilian history, like the Collor years, are a direct function of this, you know, strange system that we have in Brazil.
But just to interrupt, let's revisit for a second, for listeners who may not be aware, just what this confrontation with Rodrigo Maia was about. A couple of weeks ago, Rodrigo Maia's father-in-law gets put in jail as a result of the car wash investigation. And then Jair Bolsonaro's son on social media basically makes fun of Maia and says, "Ah, I wonder why the speaker is being so quiet." This was not like a conflict over like negotiations of the legislation. I mean, that was perhaps the backdrop. But what really got this exchange of insults between among various parties going was this incredibly sophomoric, personal, vindictive rhetoric, and an entirely self inflicted error on the part of Bolsonaro and his team. So, you know, we have to remember that these are real people with real feelings and like family lives. And I actually, at some level, I kind of admire Rodrigo Maia for, if not forgiving the Bolsonaro family, at least kind of, which I doubt, like, but, you know, taking a deep breath and saying, okay, for the good of the country, we need to advance on this thing.
This has happened before, right, with Jair Bolsonaro's sons, particularly the congressman who basically got one of the ministers fired. Well, is this going to keep happening?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to keep happening. And I think, you know, very naively, some investors thought that you could kind of isolate economic policy from the culture war and the new style of Bolsonaro, right? And this was kind of the conversation in many circles here in New York. And it was absolutely naive. And you just can't do that because you create noise and noise interferes with, you know, negotiations in Congress, with the president's approval ratings, with, you know, the media coverage and so on and so forth. And what I think, you know, I agree with Brian that kind of the boiling point was when the son of Bolsonaro attacked Rodrigo Maia. But, you know, Rodrigo Maia was already extremely frustrated with the fact that Bolsonaro was saying, look, it's not up to me to negotiate with Congress. That's your problem. Pension reform is your problem. And, well, it's not only, you know, Congress' problem. The president needs to set the tone and his team needs to go there and negotiate. So I think it was a mistake to separate these two things, right? To imagine that you would have a quote-unquote super minister in Paulo Guedes that would kind of solve the problems while you know, Bolsonaro will remain on Twitter doing, you know, whatever he does and being a radical, but that would not have real policy consequences.
See, I don't think it was naive, though. I think it was people looking at what had happened here in the United States, looking at the example of Donald Trump, and saying, well, you know, he was out there throwing bombs and doing this, you know, very vindictive political strategy and making fun of his rivals and the nicknames, and he has his family involved in politics. So, and guess what? The economy's actually gone really well here. And so why can't the same thing happen in Brazil? Because maybe this is just how politics works today. And I think, you know, I think it has exposed some differences between Brazil and the United States. One of them that we've already talked about is the economy. I think the other big one is the fact that Trump has the Republican Party behind him and has mostly, although not always, you know, kind of, let's say that he's antagonized the Republican Party less than he has the Democrats. Whereas Bolsonaro's got a party that is not only very small, in a Congress that has, what is it, 27, 28 parties in it. But it's also, it's brand new. But even some of those guys have turned against Bolsonaro over the last couple of weeks because of this vindictive style. Now, why it's worked for Trump and not for Bolsonaro, again, I political differences, economic differences, maybe cultural differences as well.
I think another big difference between the United States and Brazil is that here with the Republican Party, you know, Republicans control the Senate and they have, what, 48% of the House. Whereas in Brazil, the PSL, even though will probably soon become the largest party in the House, they have 10% of the House, right? And then the Centrão will make all the difference, which is, you know, a motley crew of people with very different interests that need this kind of, you know, one-to-one negotiation.
The Centrão, for the uninitiated, is this. It's literally the big center. It's all of these parties that are sort of occupy what I guess you'd call the center of the political spectrum.
They're not ideological, right? At the end of the day, they're, you know, mostly local leaders with, you know, with their own agenda and very conflicting interests at some point. But the point being, you know, it's how do you whip those votes and how you get, you know, people to vote for you? That's a question that Bolsonaro has not addressed yet, right?
And specifically on pension reform, what do you see as the biggest sticking points? Is it the military bill, for example, given that his cabinet is so, you know, army general heavy? Or is it just overall unpopularity of pension reform in the general population, right? Nobody wants the minimum age to be higher.
If you ask in polls whether entitlement should be cut, everybody sort of lots of people say yes, but then when it comes down to their own specific category, their own benefit, their own interest group, then that's where it gets difficult. So, but again, this, like, a lot of the groundwork for this has been laid. Bolsonaro took office with what really seemed like a pretty favorable outlook compared to the challenges that other countries have faced. And this is why so many people are frustrated with his self-defeating rhetoric and these fights that he's picking, because like they're worried that he's snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Fully agree, and I was looking at a poll that 51% of Brazilians think that, you know, there should be changes to pension reform. That's super positive. If you compare to, you know, other countries trying to, you know, deliver significant changes to their pension system, that's a hugely favorable scenario for Bolsonaro. But then, as Brian was saying, you know, one thing is to say, I support change, but when it comes to you receiving less money at the end of the month, that's a different story. And I think there are several, you know, difficult points to address, like pension for the extremely poor, the so-called BPC, that, you know, the Guedes bill is very ambitious in and wants to reduce that. And I think for many in Congress, that's just, you know, impossible. There are other issues like the rate for civil servants, how much you're going to deduct every month from their salaries. And as you pointed out, although, you know, the militaries, they're not part of the constitutional amendment proposal, they're a separate bill. You know, I think the perception right now with the bill that was introduced to Congress is that, you know, they're getting out with a pretty good deal for them, while the rest of the country will have to foot the bill. So, but the question is, you know, the initial Guedes proposal was to save 1 trillion reals in 10 years, right? If the discussion is, you know, coming down to 800 million reals in 10 years, or 700, I think that's really positive. The real problem, and I think the worst case scenario here, and by the way, I think that the most likely scenario is that we have a pension reform this year with savings around maybe 700, 600, 800 over there. But the real risk, I think, is that Congress starts diluting a lot pension reform, and you end up with a terrible bill approved.
Like 300, 400, something like
that. Yeah, something like that. That doesn't lead to fiscal consolidation, but it burns, you know, a lot of political capital, and it's going to be very hard for Bolsonaro or the next president to change. And another key discussion on pension reforms, I know investors are obsessed with the amount of money being saved, but a key part of the pension reform is removing the necessity to change the constitution every time you need to change something related to pension to the pension system, right? Yeah. The Guedes proposal is based on the idea that you can change the system through an ordinary law, right? And if, by the way, I was reading today that, you know, they're already discussing, you know, ways to block this in, you know, the preliminary commissions analyzing the project. You know, the bar for passing a constitutional amendment in Brazil is pretty high. So you need, you know, a supermajority in both houses for 2 votes. That's a lot.
We saw the stock market shooting up and down at every, you know, latest news regarding the pension reform. And I felt like it kind of flew under the radar that the central bank downgraded GDP projections for this year, which is now just 2%. That's down from like initially estimated to be 2.5%. And then coming on the heels of, you know, just 1.1% growth in 2018, is 2% enough to keep Bolsonaro's supporters happy?
So that's an interesting way you phrase that, with is it enough to keep his supporters happy? Some of them, because, and again, this is why he's, if there's a strategy to what he's doing with these, with the culture wars, it's trying to give those people something as base, something to be excited about, while the, you know, the hard and even unpopular work of pension reform and kind of these other changes goes forth. But is it enough? I would ask, is it enough to keep the peace in a country like Brazil that has been through so much trauma in these last couple of years, where you have, again, these, I guess it's 14 million unemployed, is that?
That's something like that.
It's something like that. I mean, there's a colossal amount of people who are out of work, poverty rising. The gains that were, many of the gains that were made during the good years in the 2000s, these are not people who have, you know, faced a hopeless outlook for their entire lives. Quite the contrary. These are, a lot of these people tasted a degree of, not prosperity, but had access to consumer goods for the first time. We were able to acquire a refrigerator, or maybe a small car, or an air conditioning unit. These are members of the so-called classe C, which is sort of the Brazilian term for the lower middle class. How are these people going to react if 2 years from now, or even 1 year from now, the economy is still flat? It's not a country that, Brazil is not a country that historically sits still. If people's needs are not being met, you know, the wheel will turn again. We'll see.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more with Brian. It's difficult to exaggerate the extent of, you know, how the economic slowdown in Brazil has affected people's lives. And we're talking about, you know, Brazil hasn't seen real growth above 3% since, like, 2012. Yeah. And it's not going to see, you know, real growth until, let's say, 2021, right? If you look at the IMF forecasting or the World Bank. So it's very difficult for a president to keep, you know, high levels of popularity or approval ratings under these circumstances, for sure.
I would say, just on the other side of this, that if you were, this Roberto and I, we don't agree on everything. This may be one where we differ a bit. If you were to design an agenda to bring Brazil out of that long malaise, I think it would look a lot like what Paulo Guedes has set out, right? Diffusing the fiscal time bomb that everybody agrees Social Security form represents, doing things to reduce the amount of government bureaucracy, to cutting red tape, making it easier to hire and fire people, all the sort of reforms that will take a business climate that I think in the latest World Bank Global Survey ranked 110th out of 190 countries, and getting it at least into the top half.
I agree with all that. I agree with all that. I think, you know, Brazil needs, you know, badly needs reforms. But again, this is a very polarized country at this point, and you need presidential leadership to push these things forward, right? And we're not seeing it.
So there's, you know, cutting back on bureaucracy, there's facilitating business. Are there other areas of the economy that you think could really use a proper injection to reboot? And, you know, is that energy, is that trade with the United States or with China?
I mean, there's a long list for Brazil, just as there is for a lot of countries within Latin America. But the fact is, you know, Latin America is going to close this decade having averaged growth region-wide of just 2.2%. That's barely more than half what the global economy did during that period. So I think it's fair to say that the whole region faces a challenge of reforming and specifically making investment easier that will let growth pick back up in a way that you saw during the 2000s, where the story was so great, right? I mean, you had more than 50 million Latin Americans who came out of poverty into the middle class. How do you recapture that magic? I think with the case of Brazil, you know, lots of people start with, I mean, there's basically two things. I mean, the list is actually very long, but two things. Tax reform. Not necessarily even cutting taxes that much, but simplifying them, removing a bunch of these distortions. According to the World Bank, Brazil has the most complicated tax code in the world by a pretty big margin. And then the second one is trade. Brazil is the most closed economy in the Americas if you take trade as a percentage of GDP. And those two things alone, I mean, granted, those are two really big things, but if you could make progress in those areas, it would make a positive difference. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and for the long term, I think productivity is kind of the big word, right? And also opening up for trade is key. And I think, you know, there was some important changes in the way the kind of the committee inside Brazil is structured, the committee deciding on trade policy. And basically now, Paulo Guedes has a lot of power to unilaterally reduce tariffs and, you know, promote trade. And I think, you know, as a Chicago University trained economist, he has a view that, you know, opening up, it's really key. And I tend to agree, right? If you compare the share of imports and exports as a share of GDP. So imports and exports divided by GDP. Brazil and Argentina, by the way, are on the level of like Sudan, right? Compared to other emerging countries like Turkey, like not to say Mexico, that is, has, you know, NAFTA with the United States. We are a really, really closed economy. And I feel that, you know, for the first time in decades, probably, there's a general feeling in Brazil that, you know, basically the time has come to, you know, start a new approach to trade policy. And going back to your point, I know you wanted to discuss the Bolsonaro's trip to the United States. I think trade was a big part of the agenda. There were some commitments made. No major deliverable, right? The United States committed to supporting Brazil's bid to become a member of the OECD. In exchange, Brazil said it would, you know, relinquish a privileged status at the WTO, right, as a developing nation. But these are promises, right? And I do think that if the Paulo Guedes agenda does not gain traction in Brazil, many people here in the United States will look at Brazil and, you know, not be really convinced that the Bolsonaro administration's promise of change is for real.
Okay, so then I think I'd like to take the opportunity to talk about foreign policy. Even though it wasn't maybe a guiding force during the elections, there has been a marked shift since Bolsonaro came, right? Or they say so. You know, when he arrived here in the United States, and Donald Trump said it's the best relationship the United States has had with Brazil ever. Do you believe that will really be the case? Is this going to be a new era of U.S.-Brazilian relations?
So it's true that the relationship's good right now, and it's probably better than it's certainly better than it was a few years ago. But I think that all parties have grossly overstated the supposed hostility of recent years between the two countries. You know, Barack Obama called Lula the man, and you know, and Lula had a better relationship, arguably at least at a personal level, with George W. Bush than he had with Obama.
By far.
And so, and you know, Dilma was very close to being received by the Obama White House for a state visit in 2013. It was a visit that got sabotaged at the last minute by the Edward Snowden revelations. So, you know, let's start with that. That said, I mean, this is a government, the Bolsonaro government has aligned itself with the United States to a degree. I don't think you've seen anything like it in Latin America since the Carlos Menem government in Argentina during the 1990s, which was a phrase that was, it was a period that was famously known as carnal relations between Argentina and the United States, where Argentina was kind of unquestionably supporting everything that Washington did. And the question, though, I mean, and you've seen this in lots of personal gestures from Eduardo Bolsonaro, another one of the president's sons, walking out of the Trump Hotel last December wearing a Trump 2020 hat. Okay, great. What does it actually mean? What is the product of this special alignment going to be? You know, Roberto mentioned trade. I talked to people, diplomats on both sides, who would actually, from both governments, who would be charged with actually taking negotiation forward. And what they say is, of course, trade deals are always complicated. This one would take years before it goes anywhere, in part because it's not clear that the two economies actually complement each other that well.
You mean a free trade agreement?
Yeah.
Between the two countries, yeah.
Well, following his trip to the United States, Bolsonaro then went to Chile and met with some Latin American leaders, and they signed on to this new regional bloc, Prosur. This bloc's stated purpose is, you know, overall regional integration, but Iván Duque of Colombia has expressed how he would like them to make moves on the issue of Venezuela and solving the crisis there. How important is Venezuela to the Bolsonaro administration overall?
Anything that brandishes their credentials in fighting leftism and socialism and communism and, you know, again, these are all, I'm making air quotes as I say some of these words at least, is a positive for the Bolsonaros and their base. I mean, I really believe, as somebody who's been following them for 2 years and has interviewed them, that their driving passion is basically defeating socialists and criminals, which, by the way, in their mind are often sort of part and parcel of the same group. And therefore, you know, having an active foreign policy, undermining Maduro and looking to get rid of that, you know, the communist government that's part of the Forum of Sao Paulo is very important to them.
And the reality on the ground has, you know, changed substantially, I think, in regarding the Venezuelan crisis over the past year, right? Now you have thousands and thousands of Venezuelan refugees coming in, you know, across the border to Brazil. You have, you know, a heated rhetoric about a U.S. military option in Venezuela, even if it's a bluff, you know, it is being said and repeated. And you also have a collapsing state that, you know, is changing dynamics when it comes to, you know, crime in South America, narcotics, and so on and so forth, meaning that this is a key issue for Brazil's national interest and national security, right? Even if it were not for Bolsonaro and, you know, let's say that another president had won in 2018, this would be a top foreign policy priority, regardless, with a different approach.
Ooh, but I disagree with that. I mean, Haddad, the candidate that Bolsonaro faced in the 2018 runoff, Fernando Haddad, his party has remained extremely indulgent and supportive of the Maduro regime. So I think this is, I mean, I agree with all that except for the last part. I think if Haddad was in power, it would be a radically different approach.
But I would say among the top five priorities of Brazilian foreign policy, Venezuela would certainly be there. Would Brazil have recognized Guaido? No way. With the PT in power, I totally agree with you. Would Brazil and Itamaraty be spending a lot of time thinking about what to do with, you know, the refugees on the border, or how to, you know, what to do in the Lima group, etc.? I think for sure.
Fair enough. Yeah. We'll never know. It's the thing about elections.
Okay, so turning to the issue of corruption and security, perhaps the most groundbreaking news of the last 3 months was the arrest of Bolsonaro's predecessor, Michel Temer, right? Which was part of the Lava Jato operation in Rio de Janeiro. Is this something that the new administration can take credit for?
No.
Doesn't help Bolsonaro's approval rating?
I don't think it does, but Brian is making a face.
I think my answer to that is, if you'd taken a poll on the day Temer was arrested, you probably would have registered a very small uptick in Bolsonaro's popularity. And if you'd taken a poll again the day after, it would have gone back to where it was before.
Plus all the complication in Congress with Rodrigo Maia.
Yeah, which is why at the end of the day, it was probably the arrest of Temer was probably a negative for Bolsonaro, because it prompted this huge political fight that in turn complicated pension reform, as we were saying earlier.
Okay. Well, regardless, people are expecting corruption to go down under his administration. Meanwhile, his own family has been linked to a couple different scandals. Is that affecting Bolsonaro?
It's funny, we've been talking for a while now about Bolsonaro and haven't even touched on this aspect, right? Another big disappointment among many of his supporters has been the allegations regarding particularly his oldest son, also a senator, Flavio Bolsonaro, and this so-called Laranja scandal, which is, this whole scheme is probably too complicated to explain here, but basically it's a corrupt scheme that could have resulted in kickbacks for him. He, by the way, says that he did nothing wrong. But it has still, it's taken a toll. It's part of this story of declining popularity that he's had. When I was in Brazil a couple of weeks ago, I talked to several people who said, well, you know, it turns out maybe he's almost as bad as some of the other ones. And people would generally say, I talked to tons of people while I was there, they say, well, he's probably not as corrupt as the PT, but I really hoped that he would be clean. And now it looks like there's these things. So those are the stories that people really engage with. And, you know, really, from Bolsonaro's perspective, if he got elected for for three reasons. It was probably to improve the economy, to crack down on corruption, and to reduce crime. Those were the three things that most people thought of. That and stopping the PT from coming back to power were probably the four motivating factors for people to vote for him. And for him to lose that clean image so early in his term has been a huge blow.
And his justice minister used to be the face of Lava Jato. I mean, has he lost credibility?
Moro is still very popular in Brazil. I think there were, I'm saying here as personally speaking, I'm shocked with some basic mistakes that were done by him. His relationship with Congress has not been, has very productive in different stances. He basically proposed a comprehensive package covering from, combating crime to preventing corruption. And we haven't seen this moving forward as expected in Congress. And it's a package that excludes real forms of, reforming the system to reduce incentives for corruption. And meaning, when it comes to campaign financing, lobbying, Moro is not addressing these topics that I personally think are absolutely fundamental to, in order for Brazil to make any meaningful progress towards a situation with lower levels of corruption. And on top of that, Moro indicated at several points that he would, accept the kind of the ideological approach to policymaking, while disregarding, what the data and what, experts on these subjects are, suggesting. The example of when he presented legislation to make easier for Brazilians to purchase guns, despite the fact that all the evidence shows that, increased numbers of weapons will increase numbers of death. So I'm saying all this to say, at first, there was the expectation that Moro would be kind of the rational figure pushing forward the fight against corruption and, in a way, sheltered from the thunderstorm of ideology and fights, etc. And he would be kind of the safe port for Brazilian policymakers on, security and anti-corruption. And I think over these 3 months, we've seen the opposite, actually. I don't know if Brian disagrees with me, and I know you know Moro very well.
Brian disagrees. We'll see. I think the proof will be in the pudding in terms of both the corruption investigations that go forward and whether crime comes down. There are some signs of, there was in Rio de Janeiro, for example, in January and February, homicides were down 28%. Who knows why that is? And of course, that was also accompanied by a dramatic increase in the number of people killed by police in confrontations. So lots of work to be done there. It's a country with 63,000 homicides per year, and that number has grown in recent years. And I know that especially for people in the sort of lower classes in Brazil who have to, or mostly the ones who live with the consequences of all this violence, I know that this is really top of mind for them.
And there was that school shooting in Sao Paulo where 8 people died, including the shooters. Since that happened, has it changed the rhetoric on gun ownership, in government and with the public at large?
Well, the reaction by the Bolsonaristas was very similar to Trump's reaction here to many shootings, which was, I wish the professor or the teacher had, a weapon with him to kill the person. And I don't think this episodes will dramatically shift the policy debate in Brazil at this point. But bear in mind that still for, Brazilians, the structure of the two countries, the legal structure is very different, right? Here you have state laws that kind of guide the way, you can purchase guns or what kind of license you need, where you can carry a gun around, etc. In Brazil, this is determined at the national level, and you cannot carry. It's really hard for a Brazilian to legally carry a gun, and there's no indication that Bolsonaro is willing to change that, at least for now, right? What was decided was that it's easier for you to purchase a pistol or, specific guns, but you cannot carry it around. You don't have the permit to carry it around.
Okay. And this anti-crime bill that Moro proposed, as you said, it was both corruption and also addressed rising violence. It was kind of tabled to get pension reform in as a priority. Tax reform apparently is next. Do we actually have a chance of passing this anti-crime bill?
I think so. And one would assume that given Moro's prestige, it would be very hard for Congress to say no to him, right?
Does he have many friends there?
That's the point, right? He would need to be Moro is not a politician, right? He's a judge who, you know, revolutionized the way Brazilians fight corruption. He's not a great politician when it comes to going to Congress and negotiating, you know, the nitty-gritties of legislation. But it is also important to say that he already gave up on a crucial idea of this package, which was to criminalize illegal campaign financing, which was one of the things he defended a lot when he was a judge in Curitiba, the so-called Caixa Dois, right? Illegal payments to finance campaigns. And this is a very, very comprehensive package covering from, you know, whether the police can infiltrate someone to make an arrest, all the way to, you know, penalties to, you know, organized crime and corruption. So it's a lot. I think, as Brian pointed out, there is an urge in Brazil to see things happening when it comes to, you know, improving security and fighting corruption. I think at the end, Congress will pass something, right? It's not going to be revolutionary. But it may give some improvements, and there are really positive points in Moro's proposals, right? Including increasing the penalties for public officials who are engaging with corruption, for instance.
We generally know what works when it comes to reducing violence and homicide in Latin America. It's not, none of it's sexy, and it's certainly not pouring more guns onto the streets, but it's investing in more professionalized security forces. It's in innovative social programs that and city ordinances that close bars early was massively successful in one particularly violent suburb of Sao Paulo that's often cited as a success story. It's basically through investment in human resources so that both your police and your justice system are more effective. Those are the things that will produce results over time and have contributed to, most famously in the Brazilian case, the homicide rate in Sao Paulo has come down 80% since the late 90s. Now, that story is a little bit complicated. People like to shoot holes in it, so to speak, because, you know, there's rumors of a truce with the big organized crime group, the PCC, which drove at least some of that. But I think it's largely a case of more professionalized policing and a lot of these investments. And so I think there are aspects of it that could clearly serve as a model for the rest of the country.
Great. Well, thank you guys for all your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Gonzalez. You can follow more of our coverage on Bolsonaro's first 100 days in office at as-coa.org, Bolsonaro 100. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Check out upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, please write us a review. It helps us spread the word. And subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or Stitcher.